Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and thanks for joining us for this episode of New Books in Philosophy, which is part of the New Books Network. I'm Robert Talese. I'm professor of philosophy at Vanderbilt University. I co-host the program with Carrie Figder, Malcolm Keating, and Sarah Tyson. My guest today is Blaine Neufeld. Blaine is associate professor of philosophy at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. His research is centrally in political philosophy, with an emphasis on political liberalism and public reason. His new book has just been published with Routledge. It's titled Public Reason and Political Autonomy, Realizing the Ideal of a Civic People. Now, according to a familiar picture, a democracy is a free society of self-governing equals. This means that citizens have a duty to participate in the processes of democratic governance. Moreover, it's often held that their participation should be aimed at acknowledging their fellow citizens' status as democratic equals. Now, on a dominant interpretation of this idea, this acknowledgement comes by way of how citizens conduct themselves in political decision-making contexts, including especially contexts of political reasoning, disagreement, and debate. Now, this raises the issue of the kinds of reasons that one might bring to public political discourse. On a view associated with John Rawls, theorists of liberal democracy need to distinguish between properly public reasons, that is, the kinds of reasons that are appropriate for public decision-making contexts, and reasons that might be morally weighty, but nonetheless are not appropriate for public decision-making. Now, of course, that distinction is fraught. In Public Reason and Political Autonomy, Blaine Neufeld defends a novel view of the nature and role of public reason in a democratic society. Now, as usual, there is a lot to talk about, but we'll begin, as we usually do, with our guest, the author. Hello, Blaine.
Hi, Bob.
How are you today?
I'm good. How are you?
Oh, hanging in, you know, it's the end of an academic year, so things are always a little bit hectic. So, you know, we usually begin these interviews with a little bit about the author. You know, can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. I grew up in London, Ontario, and I went to the University of Toronto for my undergraduate degree, and there I studied political science. And I took some political theory courses, but they tended to be of a more history of political thought in nature. So courses on Plato, Aristotle, Locke, and so forth. And I thought I was interested more in the international relations side of political science. But I was also, you know, I liked political theory. And then I went to Oxford for an MPhil in politics. And there things really changed for me. I took seminars with Jerry Cohen and David Miller. I attended lectures with, you know, given by Ronald Dworkin. And I kind of was exposed to analytical political philosophy for the first time. And I thought, well, this is really, you know, this is what I want to do. I really enjoyed interacting with those philosophers and their style of doing political philosophy. So after I finished my MPhil, I guess there was a few years, a bit of a gap there, but then I eventually got into the PhD program in philosophy, so at the University of Michigan. And there I studied with Liz Anderson and Stephen Darwall. And I actually began my dissertation there aiming to criticize and reject Rawlsian political liberalism. Because I thought at the time there were serious problems with it. But I thought, well, at least what I should do is construct the strongest case possible for the political liberal if I'm going to criticize it. You know, that's what you want to do in philosophy. You don't want to attack the straw man or a caricature of the view. You want the strongest view you can. And by the time I finished constructing what I took to be the strongest view of it, I thought, oh, this is right. So I kind of argued myself into a position I previously had been opposed to. After I finished my dissertation, I kind of wandered the world for a while. I spent 3 years at Stanford in the Introduction to the Humanities program, and then 3 years at Trinity College Dublin, before eventually getting a tenure track job at the University of Wisconsin in Milwaukee in 2008. And I guess I've been teaching there ever since, including being chair for 3 years. Which I finished just before my sabbatical, and half that term overlapped with the pandemic, which made it even more agonizing than normal. So that's sort of my intellectual journey so far.
That's wonderful. You know, I was chair of my department for nearly a decade and got out just. just as the pandemic was, in 2020, the academic year 19 and 20. So, I feel like I was lucky to have not had to, manage a department that was struggling to learn what Zoom was and find connect a web camera and everything. I feel for whatever you had to endure as part of that process. Why don't we talk about the book? As political philosophers, we tend to think, with some justification, I would say, that everyone knows what we mean by political liberalism and Rawlsian, late Rawlsian liberal ideas. But maybe not every listener to the podcast in this particular episode of it will know what those terms mean, and they're more technical meanings within contemporary political philosophy. So why don't we begin where the book actually begins, with the background, right? With the background of what we in the field call political liberalism, which is contrasted with comprehensive or sometimes perfectionist liberalism. Now, it's always struck me that no matter what one might think of Rawls's positive theses in political philosophy, it's sort of hard to not admire, right, the framework that gets devised, especially in the later work, for stating a core justificatory problem for liberalism. So can you just sort of set up the broad problematic that political liberalism is in part the attempt to diagnose and respond to?
Yeah, sure. So I'll do it by way of talking a bit about why Rawls felt the need to become what he called the political liberal and what that means. So in a widely read book from 1971, A Theory of Justice, Rawls formulates and defends an egalitarian liberal conception of justice, which is now known as justice as fairness. And I could get into the content of that conception later if it's helpful, but broadly speaking, it's a liberal conception that, you know, tries to secure equal individual rights for all citizens, but it's also egalitarian, and then it tries to secure a high degree of economic and political equality among citizens. Part of this defense of this conception of justice as fairness in that book, was thinking about whether a society that realized justice would be stable over time. And this is important, Rawls thinks, because political justice should not be self-defeating or fragile in nature. That is, if you actually manage to achieve it in society, you don't want it to only last a generation or to fall apart. You want justice has a kind of practical function, that it should structure society so that it can be a framework that for ongoing social cooperation across generations, that it has a kind of robustness, institutional robustness to it. Moreover, it's not just any kind of stability that Rawls was concerned with. You can imagine realizing a stable society through deception, right? Through something like Plato's noble lie, where you don't, most people don't know the truth, but you achieve stability that way. Or you can have a stable society through intimidation and fear of death, sort of Hobbes's Leviathan picture. But for Rawls, he thought, those kinds of stability aren't the kind that are compatible with his conception of justice, which is, involves free and equal citizens. So you want a certain kind of stability. And Rawls thought he could get a just society that was stable, and it'd be stable in the right way, because it would depend on the free support of its citizens. But its citizens would freely endorse the institutions of their, what he calls their basic structure, their main political and economic institutions. And they would do so because in a fully just society, they would enjoy what can be known as full autonomy. And autonomy, self-government, that's what the word means, has, at least in the theory of justice, has at least two elements. And one is a kind of institutional element, that is, you want the institutions in place that enable citizens to participate in politics as equals, so they have the rights and resources to take part in political decision-making. But it also has this justificatory element, that citizens are fully autonomous, Rawls thought, and this is kind of an element that's consistent throughout his thinking, when institutions are justified in ways that they accept, that they're not alien to them. And in the theory of justice, Rawls thought that all citizens could endorse the principles of justice as fairness. They would endorse it, those principles, and hence they would have justificatory autonomy as well as institutional autonomy. Now, Rawls thought that they would have justificatory autonomy because citizens would all endorse the principles of justice and fairness. And the reason he thought they would endorse them is because these principles, the story is quite complicated, but simplifying somewhat, the citizens would endorse them because those principles would express their deepest interests as that is, their underlying nature as free, self-determining, rational agents. That is, the principles would best capture the idea that they're the essence of personhood is that of rational self-direction, independent of unchosen empirical contingencies. And I won't get into the details of what that story involves, but we can see, just based on that description, it's a pretty Kantian view. And if people are listeners are interested, there's an excellent discussion of this view of the Rawls's account of stability in a theory of justice by Paul Wightman in his book Why Political Liberalism, which I draw a lot on, learned a lot from. So why is this a problem? Well, Rawls eventually came to think that the free institutions of a just society would actually prevent everyone from agreeing on this kind of robustly Kantian view of their fundamental interests. That is, a liberal society would be one in which citizens invariably would disagree over certain fundamental metaphysical and moral questions. Citizens would adopt different worldviews, what he calls comprehensive doctrines. Some citizens might really be taken with this Kantian picture and think that's the way to go. But others, through the free exercise of their reason, might adopt different views. They might, have a utilitarian view about morality and personhood, or some might adopt religious views. They might be Buddhists or Christians, and they would have a very different, they might, and from those alternative worldviews, this claim that our essential nature involves this rational self-determination is might not make sense, or might not be one that they think is actually fundamental. So, and more, what's important for to understand political liberalism is that these disagreements are not simply the result, or not always the result of, say, false beliefs or poor reasoning, right? I mean, they might be in many cases. I mean, people have all kinds of, you know, crazy beliefs, false beliefs, but even people reasoning as well as human beings can be expected to reason will inevitably come to, or at least this is the claim of political liberalism, will inevitably come to endorse different comprehensive doctrines. Like, this is a kind of a built-in feature of the limitations of human reason or the nature of human reasoning. And Rawls argued that this reasonable pluralism, that is the kind of pluralism that would be the result of even conscientious, careful reflection on moral and metaphysical questions, could only be eliminated by political oppression, right? And so any liberal theory has to accommodate what he calls the fact of reasonable pluralism. And political liberalism is essentially this attempt to do so, right? So how can we have a society that is stable in the right way, that is stable because through citizens' political agency, through their political autonomy, one that allows for the respect for disagreement over which comprehensive doctrine, if any, is true. And so this is where public reasoning comes in. So according to Rawlsian political liberalism, if we justify fundamental political questions by means of public reasons, then the basic structure of society will be justifiable to all citizens, despite the fact they have these, you know, deeper disagreements about the nature of morality or whether God exists and so forth. And public reasons have this kind of freestanding nature. They appeal to ideas of citizens as free and equal and society's a fair system of social cooperation. And the claim that political liberals make is that, well, these are political ideas. They're normative ideas. They're nonetheless ideas that can be endorsed by citizens who adhere to a wide range of different religious and moral and other kinds of doctrines. So you still have institutional autonomy. Citizens are free and equal citizens. They can participate in the political decision-making processes of the society, but they also enjoy a kind of justificatory autonomy, because if we justify these decisions in terms of public reasons, those are going to be reasons that are going to be acceptable to all citizens, or at least all reasonable citizens, despite the fact that some citizens will be Buddhists, others will be atheist Kantians, you know, others will be Catholics and so forth.
Right. Can I just ask a quick sort of clarifying question? Because I take it that it's important for the kind of Rawlsian story that public reasons aren't always to articulate a reason publicly. Or to articulate a reason within the bounds of publicity, it's, you know, a public reason isn't always a conclusive reason, right? Public reasons can be strong or weak or defeated. Is that right?
That's correct. Yes, totally. So you could have, it could be a political issue, and there might be multiple public reasons with respect to it. Some might be stronger than others, and they can be in conflict with each other. So I don't mean to suggest that, by means of public reasoning, citizens will arrive at unique solutions to every political question. And in fact, there might be, even if citizens share the same political conception of justice, there might be disagreements about how best to interpret it or how best to realize it in terms of policy. So even citizens who all say share are equally committed to Rawls' own conception of justice as fairness, they might disagree about, well, what kinds of institutions would best realize that conception, right? So, you know, in the literature today, there's debates over alternatives to capitalism, such as property-owning democracy, which is a kind of private property-owning regime, but it relies on a high level of equality through private ownership. And then there's people who think, well, you need some form of liberal or democratic socialism in order to realize Rawls's principles. And so you can have those kinds of disagreements. But on top of that, you might have people who endorse somewhat different reasonable political conceptions of justice, right? These different conceptions of justice are freestanding. Like, they appeal to the ideals of free and equal citizens. They don't presuppose the truth of any comprehensive doctrine and so forth. But they might differ somewhat. Rawls always thought that his conception was the most reasonable one, and I guess I kind of agree with him on that. But that's compatible with recognizing that there are other reasonable conceptions of justice that also gives his citizens public reasons. But the important thing is, for the purpose of justification, is that these justifications are appeal to other people in their capacity as free and equal citizens, and they don't presuppose the truth of, say, utilitarianism, right, or a particular religious view.
Right. So would it be right to say that the later Rawlsians' interest in public reason is ultimately an interest in establishing a kind of framework for political discussion and disagreement in decision-making contexts among people understood as free and equal citizens, given the fact that we can't count on them sharing fundamental metaphysical, theological, or even normative in some broad sense, starting points. Does that sound right?
I couldn't have said it better myself. That's exactly
so
right.
It's a framework. Yep. It's not a, it's a framework for discussion and debate, not a pipeline for finding the right answers to important political questions.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. But I do think it filters out certain views, obviously, right? So a classical utilitarian view that can only be justified, you know, on utilitarian grounds is not, you know, if you can't formulate a public reason justification for the policies, if you have to appeal to comprehensive utilitarian reasons, then that's not going to be something that can be that fits within the framework. So it's going to filter out options, but it won't by itself uniquely determine certain outcomes.
Good. Right. So the utilitarian who offers as a justification for some particular policy, the greatest happiness principle says it, is failing at public reasoning. Is that right?
Yes, if that's all.
If he stops there.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, if that's all that particular citizen or public official can say, then yes, that's violates what Rawls calls the duty of civility, because that person is giving a justification for a law. Say they're defending physician-assisted suicide on utilitarian grounds, and that's the only justification they can give. Then they're insisting on a kind of deciding a very important political question on grounds that other citizens simply cannot accept, for citizens who don't agree with the utilitarian doctrine. Now, if that same citizen also said, well, but here's also a public reason argument for why physician assisted suicide should be permitted in certain cases that appeals to that rests on public reasons. Like I say, it appeals to the interest that citizens have in controlling their lives. Then that's fine. So you can give both. I mean, you could say, here's both the utilitarian justification for this law or this political proposal that I think should become law, and here's a public reason justification. That's perfectly okay. As a non-utilitarian, I might say, well, it's great that you have your utilitarian justification, but what reasons do I have for thinking that your proposed law is one that I should, you know, take seriously? And then if you can give me a public reason justification, then I say, okay, that's a reason to at least take it seriously. Maybe I don't find it decisive, but at least you're appealing to considerations that are ones I can weigh, like that are things that I can take seriously as a in my capacity as a fellow citizen.
Good. Can I ask one other just question about the nuts and bolts of this before we get into the political autonomy, the full political autonomy stuff in the book? So just picking up on the utilitarian and the assisted suicide claim. So imagine I'm a utilitarian. Does the public reason have to? And I can get, you know, I can announce the public reason in making my public case for physician assisted suicide. Do I have to find the public reason at all compelling? I mean, can my motivating reasons be strictly utilitarian? Is there any? So if I support assisted suicide for straightforward utilitarian reasons, but know that when I'm talking in public, I have to also at least give these public reasons. Does it matter if I find the public reasons kind of unpersuasive?
I think it does matter. I mean, ideally, the public reasons alone, the public reason justification you give should be sufficient for you. So this is sometimes is referred to the sincerity requirement of the duty of civility. And Micah Schwartzman has a very interesting article that defends this idea. So one way to think about it is that would I find this public reason justification sufficient to motivate my support for the political proposal, even if I didn't have the comprehensive reasons already there? So even if I imagine myself as not, like, say I didn't have the utilitarian argument, would the public reason justification still be one that I think is, makes the case for the law? And if I don't think it does, then I realize I'm kind of being insincere. I'm using the public reason stuff more as rhetoric than as a sincere justification to my fellow citizens. Having said that, I think that even being able to give a public reason justification is better than not being able to give a public reason. So this is an ideal that we should strive to achieve. But even if we fall short, I mean, maybe at least giving some kind of public reason justification for a position is better than not giving any at all.
I see. Good. So central to your defense of this, of doing liberal political philosophy in a way that requires us to theorize about public reasons and other kinds of reasons. So central to your defense of that idea is the idea of full political autonomy and shared political autonomy. Can you sort of pull the focus back and tell us sort of the slightly bigger picture about why getting public reason right is an important part of understanding a liberal democratic society?
Sure. So let me talk a bit about shared political autonomy. So I've already mentioned institutional autonomy and justificatory autonomy. So institutional autonomy just has to do, it's very important, but has to do with the institutions that enable citizens, to participate politically. And justificatory autonomy has to do with the justifications for the laws that citizens are subject to. Like, can good justifications be given, justifications that are acceptable to citizens? But I also think that that full political autonomy includes shared autonomy. And I started thinking about this idea of shared autonomy because of a number of rather Rousseauian descriptions of the idea of public reason that Rawls gives. So just one example from Justices Fairness, a restatement, Rawls writes, public reason is the form of reasoning appropriate to citizens who, as a corporate body, impose rules on one another by sanctions of state power. So that's just one passage from Rawls, but there's a number of passages very similar to this one in Rawls's writings on political liberalism and public reason. And they struck me as all being quite Rousseauian in nature, and I mean that as a compliment.
that's important to mention.
And I thought, can we make sense of it? I mean, or is he just being metaphorical here, or is he just engaging in some uncharacteristically romantic language? Can we make sense of it? And so I thought that we could make sense of it if Rawls's references to corporate and collective agency. If we draw upon Michael Brantman's theory of shared agency, and I call this the civic people account of political liberalism. And very roughly, I suggest that citizens attempting to realize the ideal of shared political autonomy in a pluralist society would commit themselves to what Brantman calls a shared policy, to give weight only to public reasons in their decisions concerning fundamental political matters. And so this shared policy, or shared policies in general, are kinds of ongoing shared intentions. So a shared intention might just be we intended to do this interview. So that's kind of a shared intention that we had. But when this interview is over, that's the end of that shared, we've succeeded in fulfilling our intention we fulfilled our plan. Whereas policies are somewhat different in that they have a more extended duration. And they concern our deliberations about things too. So shared policies, according to Brantman, constitute a commitment on the part of individuals in a group to structuring their shared deliberation and planning in a certain way. So just as a kind of a simple example that I'm sure you're familiar with, I'm painfully familiar with, is being on a university hiring committee. So you're trying to figure out how to hire a candidate for an open position. And usually what this involves, among other things, is coming up with a set of criteria, right? So how much weight should we give to teaching? How much weight to research? How much weight should we give to the letters of recommendation, to past service? And we adopt policies like, okay, we want to count, research this much and service this much, and this kind of research or this kind of service is especially important, say. And we, the people on the hiring committee, say, okay, yes, we all agree with it, or we all agree to abide by this. Maybe I, as an individual, think, well, I actually would prefer a different ranking, but I come to agree that, okay, this is what we, this is, these are the shared policies that we all will abide by, right? And that kind of structures our deliberation. So there's a kind of, you have a group agent here, the hiring committee, and they've adopted a set of shared policies for the deliberations. That's a kind of an everyday example of what a shared policy is and what a shared agent is. So I try to argue in the book that a commitment on the part of reasonable citizens to employ public reasons when deciding fundamental political matters can be understood as an instance of such a shared policy as a kind of Brantmanian shared policy. This shared policy constitutes the group in question as a self-governing civic people. And so I think that this view can render plausible Rawls's references to free and equal citizens as making up a collective or corporate body, and that public reasoning is the way that citizens do this. It can show why thinking of citizens as constituting a collective or corporate body doesn't commit us to anything metaphysically weird or normatively normatively controversial, since Brantman's account is aims at being reductionist in nature and naturalist and so forth. So he's not he's not Hegel, it's all kosher from the point of view of political liberalism, which wants to avoid controversial metaphysical commitments and so forth. So the idea of a civic people, moreover, can I think it helps illuminate the close connection between the ideals of public reason and democratic self-government. That is, the relevant shared policy provides this kind of connection. Like, citizens all commit themselves in this way and become self-governing through this shared policy to public reasoning. This, of course, I'm going to raise an objection to my own view just very quickly, raising the question, a political society is a pretty big thing. So it's not, talking about shared, collective agents or shared agency and shared policies when thinking about university hiring committees or sports teams or when people get together to paint a house and these kinds of situations. That's one thing. But what about, a large scale political society? Well, so what I try to do in the book as well is try to explain how to scale up Bratman's account. And I think that we can do this. It doesn't, the shared intention doesn't require that every single citizen have this ongoing policy foremost in their minds all the time, and that they are attentive to the interdependency of this shared intention as well. Rather, I think we can think that, well, so long as we there's a way to make sure that when political decisions are being made, we can determine at least with some degree of confidence whether the people making those decisions are using public reasons and thus adhering to the policy. And so I discuss this idea of the public political forum, which is from Rawls's term, but it's sort of where the decisions actually are made. And it's where public reasoning really comes out most vividly. These are sort of when votes are made in Parliament or Congress by legislators, when decisions are issued by the Supreme Court or Constitutional Court, and so forth. And we can look at these public records, see if public reasons are being used. We can look at the behavior of the officials in question, and we can decide whether or not they're actually adhering to this shared policy, right? And likewise with citizens in general, we look at the public political culture and overall voting behavior, whether or not they're adhering to this kind of shared policy. Now, I want to emphasize right away, this is an ideal that is not it's something to be aimed at. I'm not giving a description of any existing liberal democratic society. This is part of the normative project of what would a fully, a fully legitimate, what would a society that in which the ideal of public reason is fulfilled, what would that look like? And that's the account that I'm trying to give.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com, code POD.
Right. So let me pick up on that because, one, I think, familiar and of, according to very many people at least, compelling line of criticism, even about the very idea of a distinction between public and non-public reasons, let alone the kind of account you've just given, the civic people account of what role public reason plays in a liberal democratic society. But a compelling line of reason of all that is that any such Rawlsian view is going to be doomed because of how many idealizations are involved, right? That this is inevitably an instance of ideal theory, and what's being called reasonable doesn't really match any actual citizens' way of thinking about things. In some cases, this kind of objection, as I'm sure you know, gets cast as the idea that reasonableness is just being defined by in terms of what some particularly positioned kind of person in society finds agreeable. Can you say something about that sort of general line of critique and how you respond to it? You have a whole chapter on it.
Yeah, so I have, that's right. I have the third chapter of the book, which is the shortest chapter, is on this concern about ideal theory. And this actually chapter developed out of a paper that I gave at this conference. I know you were there. Bowling Green State
that's
University.
Right. I think that's where we might have first met.
Yes, that's right. So this is the chapter, sort of the descendant of that paper. I think hopefully it makes a bit more sense than the original presentation did. But so there's this a line of criticism of ideal theory and its connection to public reason. So there's what I would call the standard view of the relation between ideal theory and public reasoning, and this is, I think, the view that. That is natural to attribute to Rawls based on many things that he says. And it goes something like the following. First, we formulate a political conception of justice. And we do this with reference to an idea of what Rawls calls the well-ordered society, right? So the well-ordered society is a society that fully realizes a conception of justice. And one feature of this well-ordered society is the strict compliance by its members with the requirements of justice. And this, the well-ordered society, this fully just society, which citizens freely comply with, Rawls describes as a kind of realistic utopia, right? So it's realistic. I mean, Rawls takes seriously like the limitations of human nature, but it's also so he's not, he thinks that justice can't ask people to do impossible things or even things that are, would require them to sacrifice their fundamental interests or anything like that. But at the same time, it's the sort of the limit of what is politically possible. So it's utopian in that respect, but it's meant to be realistically utopian. And then Rawls, then the view holds that, well, once we formulate the conception of justice that way, then we can draw upon it, including public reasons can be drawn from this conception when trying to address injustices in existing non-ideal societies, right? So in trying to figure out, how to reform the healthcare system, we use public reasons to provide justifications for the proposals that we have, but these public reasons are ultimately derived from conceptions of justice that are formulated with reference to this notion of a just, well-ordered society. All right, so that's the structure of the standard view. Now, ideal theory has been subject to all kinds of criticisms over the last 15 years, as you know. But I'll just mention two for the purpose of this discussion and explain how I try to respond to it. Now, so I'll talk about criticisms advanced by my former mentor, Elizabeth Anderson. And she criticizes the strict compliance assumption. She thinks it's unrealistic. And this is a criticism that others have advanced, certainly, like Amartya Sen and Gerald Gauss. And she also criticizes the idea that this idea of a well-ordered society is a kind of perspective outside of the society we're in, right? So the problem with ideal theory is it adopts a perspective external to the political practices that it evaluates. Sen also advances something like this criticism. He calls the view that Rawls has transcendental institutionalism. And they argue that instead, Anderson argues that we should begin with the identification of problems or injustices within our practices, that is, we find injustices, we're confronted with injustices in the society in which we live, and we should seek to find solutions to them at the level of non-ideal theory. So non-ideal theory, which is the approach to thinking about justice that Anderson favors, begins with the diagnosis of the problems and complaints of our society and investigates how to overcome them. And she has this interesting analogy with the practice of medicine. And this gives rise to the question, if ideal theory has all these problems, and I've just only mentioned two, can we have public reason, though, without it? And some people have suggested yes. I think Gerald Gauss has, well, not exactly Rawlsian public reason, but something like public reason, right? So mutual justification. So Gerald Gauss thinks we can, Elizabeth Anderson thinks we can, although, I mean, her idea of democratic equality has this kind of mutual justification element to it. Amartya Sen thinks we can. So you can sever the relation between something like public reasoning, you know, or an idea similar to it, and idea theory. And I guess I argue that, in fact, these ideas are, there's a connection between them, and they're not as necessarily easily severable as some people claim. And I kind of have this I say, well, let's think about what it is to make a political proposal in non-ideal theory, right? So something like what Anderson recommends: we're confronted with an injustice, we try to come up with a proposal to address it. Well, what does that involve, coming up with a proposal to address it? Well, and if we also still want to be committed to something like public reason, that, well, I argue that, well, part of a public reason justification for a political proposal is a claim that this justification is going to be acceptable to other reasonable citizens. I mean, that's simply what it is, right? To satisfy, you know, this reciprocity condition, right? And so, if that's the case, then what's the connection between the acceptability of a justification for a law or a proposal and compliance with it? Well, I think that it makes sense that if someone finds a justification for a law acceptable, compelling, they would also want to comply with that law, right? So if someone says, well, look, here's a justification for a law or a political proposal, and say it's passed democratically through legitimate political processes, that would seem to give me my acceptance of the justification would seem to give me sufficient reason, all things being equal, to comply with it, with that requirement. And so I suggest that public reason justifications for particular political proposals involve what I call local ideal theorizing. That is, thinking about an amended basic structure in which the proposal is implemented, and that if citizens find the justification for that proposal compelling, or at least adequately acceptable to them, then that would give them a reason, all things being equal, to comply with it. And so we get compliance that way. And in terms of full-blown ideal theorizing, it seems natural, I think, that, you know, if I look at my society, I think, oh, much needs to be done in terms of improving its justice. I have a number of political proposals for improving the justice of my society. It seems natural to want to wonder, to think, well, do these proposals all fit together? Right? And do they make sense, or do they conflict or undermine one another? And so I might want to engage a kind of a deeper form, a broader form of reflection on these various commitments of mine. I might want to think about what underlying principles, you know, can explain these commitments. And so once I start engaging in that kind of practice, I start doing what I call a full ideal theorizing. I start thinking about, well, what would a fully just version of my society look like, you know? And again, all the proposals that I put forward, though, are ones that are given in terms of public reason. So they're all concerned with acceptability. And so the claim is, I don't claim that there's a necessary connection between local ideal theorizing and full ideal theorizing, but there's just a natural pressure. You know, if you engage in a lot of, if you think about your political commitments a lot, I mean, maybe this is a vice that I have as a philosopher, but I think that it's natural to want to, you know, to want to make, if you have a number of political commitments, to want them to at least line up in a coherent way. So I think that at the end of this, so we start with, you know, here's a particular injustice, here's a proposal to address that injustice. I want to give if I'm committed to this mutual justification process that Anderson, Gauss, Sen, and so forth, they're all committed to it as well, then I want to make the justifications I give for the proposal acceptable to others. That seems to entail a kind of compliance feature. And then if I start thinking more and more about the various proposals that I think justice requires, then I start getting something that that looks like full ideal theorizing that gets us to the ideal theory picture, or at least close to it. So that's how I respond to just mentioning the two criticisms that at the beginning, I think we get compliance, and we also get a kind of the thinking about a realistic utopia again, but just through a different route. I mean, the other direction, really.
Yeah, you know, I found this chapter really, really helpful because, my own thinking about the ideal, non-ideal theory stuff, I always, not knowing even, I guess, to this day, not knowing exactly where I stand on the issue, I always thought that something was being claimed by the non-idealist, something was being claimed about ideal theorizing by the non-idealist that I thought was not fair to the ideal theory. Well, to at least certain kinds of ideal theory, right? That there were more subtleties to the various views about what ideal theory is and how it works and what it's supposed to get us than some of the real blunt criticisms, including the Sen style criticisms. That chapter, I think, really helped me see at least one way in which ideal theory could be understood as much more nuanced and responsive and sensitive to facts and all the rest. So, I wanted to make sure that we get to talk about the two chapters at the end of your five chapter book. And so in the interest of time, I'm going to sort of collapse questions about them because they both kind of, they dovetail nicely. So your fourth chapter is about children in public reason liberalism. And the fifth chapter and the basic structure and what the basic structure encompasses, particularly whether it encompasses with families are part of the basic structure, an old Susan Okin theme. And then your fifth chapter is about civic education. And you want to claim that the political liberal can embrace a certain modified version of the non-domination view of liberty. Can you put those two together and explain for us sort of how those two discussions round out the civic people account?
Sure. The last two chapters, I guess, are the applied part of the book, right? I advance an understanding of the basic structure that differs a bit from Rawls's. And I think can overcome some of the criticisms of political liberalism that feminist thinkers like Susan Okin have advanced, as well as engage with the question of like the place of children in students in liberalism. So my understanding of the basic structure. So the basic structure has always been this, the primary subject of justice in Rawls's writings, from theory of justice through political liberalism. That's never really changed. Some features of the basic structure are pretty obvious. So it includes the political constitution, its various institutions, the system of property rights and so forth. There's some things that it never applied to and still doesn't, right? So, or at least not, are not considered fully part of the basic structure, like religious institutions, clubs, cultural communities, things like that. That are, we can call them voluntary associations. These are things you can join or leave. So they're not part of the basic structure, at least not in a direct way. Now, where do families fall in? So Rawls claims in various places, and also in response to Okin at one point, that families are part of the basic structure. But they're part of the basic structure in a very funny way, in that the principles of justice apply to families in much the same way they apply to voluntary associations, that is, as indirect constraints. So it's kind of his ultimate treatment of families is a bit odd, in that he sort of recognizes the force of some of Okin's points and says, well, no, families are very important. They should be considered part of the basic structure. But when he talks about how the principles of justice apply to the family, they seem to apply in pretty much the same way they apply to churches, or they apply to, universities or other kinds of institutions that are not directly part of the basic structure, in that the principles of justice act as indirect constraints. So for example, a church can be non-democratic, but it can't, it's indirectly constrained in that it can't violate or constrain the democratic rights of its members, with respect to the political institutions and so forth, right? And so families are similar in Rawls's view, in that they can be organized in various ways as long as they don't constrain or undermine the rights that people have as citizens within the broader society. Now, this was Okun, in her final writings on political liberalism, was not satisfied with this response. So what I try to do in the book is provide a kind of more nuanced account of the basic structure. And my view is that instead of thinking about institutions as either belonging to the basic structure, wholesale, or not belonging to the basic structure, I think there are going to be many institutions have aspects that are directly regulated by the principles of justice. And I think families are among them. There are going to be aspects of families that are directly shaped by the laws of society, by laws, that is, laws concerning divorces, policies concerning childcare, these assumptions about work hours. These are all things that are part of the basic structure that directly impact the way in which families can be organized, right? So I think aspects of the family should be understood as directly subject to the principles of justice as part of the basic structure. And I think if we understand that families in this way, we can incorporate within a political liberal framework many of the proposals that Okun and other feminists have made for better realizing gender equality. So things like subsidized childcare, flexible working hours for parents, gender-neutral parental leave, and so forth. These proposals all can be justified by public reasons, and can be understood concerning families, but those aspects of families that are part of the basic structure. Now, this leaves large parts of family life outside of the basic structure, of course, and rightfully so. That's what I think a liberal view has to do. But I also think this view of the basic structure helps delineate the legitimate scope of parents' authority with respect to children. That is, how much authority should parents have to raise children in accordance with their religious or other worldviews? And on the one hand, I think there's actually a lively debate in philosophy about how much authority parents should have over children. But I think a liberal view would hold that they should have a wide scope to raise their children, in accordance with their comprehensive doctrines and conceptions of the good, but it needs to be limited nonetheless. We need to ensure that children can become free and equal citizens once they reach adulthood. That is, that there's nothing, they're not impeded from becoming full-blown free and equal citizens, that is, becoming politically autonomous themselves, right? So an education that stunted or prevented children from acquiring the skills and knowledge they need to become free and equal citizens, that should not be permitted. So there's a limited parental authority. Parents, on my view, should be free to live in accordance with their comprehensive doctrines, including in their relationships with their children, but they should not be able to prevent their children from becoming free and equal citizens. And so this connects, so this kind of division of labor view that I provide here or advocate for, that we can accommodate the fact of reasonable pluralism by providing parents and communities with room to live in accordance with their deepest values and beliefs, while also demanding that children, as a matter of justice, learn about their rights, freedoms, and duties as citizens. And so this connects up with the final chapter on citizenship education, where I argue that an adequate citizenship education should teach students the knowledge, skills, and concepts necessary for them to become rational, reasonable, and politically autonomous citizens. So they need to learn about their rights and resources as citizens, so they know that as citizens they're free to choose, which, you know, what Rawls calls a conception of the good they want to pursue. They have the right to pursue a different conception of the good than their parents or the ones that they've been raised in, and they need the resources to do this. In addition, they should be taught how to act on a sense of justice. So they need to learn about the values, principles, and ideals that underlie liberal democracy, including the ideas of citizens as free and equal persons and society as a fair system of social cooperation. They should learn about what political rights they have, how to exercise them effectively. And they should also learn how to interact with others on the basis of civic respect. And here the key element of civic respect is, you know, justifying political positions regarding fundamental political matters with public reasons. So students should learn how to engage with others in public reasoning, to put it simply. And this is necessary for them to become, when fully politically autonomous citizens as adults. And I, you know, in the book, I outline a pedagogic strategy for doing this, and I have some thoughts about the scope for, say, educational choice within this framework. But the important point, though, is that I think that the view that I defend requires a kind of education for all students that ensures they're at least capable of becoming politically autonomous persons as citizens, right? And so that's kind of the limit of tolerating a reasonable pluralism. Like you can't tolerate practices that would impede the ability of students to become free and equal citizens.
That's very good. We're just about running out of time, and you've been very generous. But I wanted to, and I thank you for that. But ask you to reflect. You know, we usually don't think, and maybe this is an error. You know, as political philosophers, we don't turn to Rawlsian political liberalism as a critical tool for evaluating our society. We usually look to other styles of political philosophy as modes of social critique. But it just struck me that in the book, the kind of account you give of civic education and what its purpose is, and you know what latitude parents have, whatever, you know, it sort of gives us an opening for thinking of the Rawlsian as sort of a pretty potent social critic, given what I'm sad to say is happening in the country around public education, where it seems like there's a good number of citizens who think that public education is invalidated whenever it does not, or is in some way invalid whenever it does not reinforce their particular conception of things. I don't know if their particular comprehensive doctrines is too lofty to put it. But if kids are going to come home from public school saying things that sound unfamiliar to the parents, that's a criticism of the public school system. And it looks as if you've worked out a way to say in a Rawlsian vocabulary, no, that's backwards. Is that right?
I think that's exactly right. Yes. I mean, we live in a very diverse pluralist society, and citizens need to, I mean, this is a lot part of your work. Citizens need to, in order to maintain democracy, learn to interact with one another in respectful ways. And one of the places you learn how to do that are in schools. That's where students first, in many cases, start interacting with people from very different backgrounds.
And they have those interactions outside of the view of their parents.
Exactly. Yes.
Yeah.
And so that's not to be lamented. So it's, excuse me. So the parents shouldn't be upset that students are learning about different worldviews or ways of living and so forth. They should welcome that, because I mean, in a way, students are going to find out about these things eventually anyway, right? You know, as adults. And why not find out about different worldviews, religions, ways of life in an educative, in a structured educational setting, where norms of civic respect can be implemented or realized. That seems like a far better way than learning about other ways of life on social media, for instance. It is very disturbing what's happening in many states now about people, parents in particular, protesting that their children might be exposed to ideas that they personally don't like. I mean, that's just. As a political liberal, I think that you should want that. You should want that exposure. And especially if it's well structured, and respectful. And I do think the political liberal framework of thinking about education, is a framework for critically assessing a lot of what's going on now.
Yeah, because just one thought on this, because the language of parental choice in these matters, which, potent in its own way, anytime you're talking about people being able to make their own choices, it sounds like you're, doing good liberalism. But I guess that your account enables us to say, well, but these are choices being made on behalf of another person who is a future citizen. And your view gives us sort of the language to say, and those choices can't impede your child's ability to become a citizen in good standing normatively of our society. Is that right?
Yes, that's exactly right.
Well, good. Blaine, I want to thank you again for joining us on New Books in Philosophy. It was, really great to read your book and to engage with the ideas in it. So, thanks.
Well, thank you, Bob.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you, listeners, for joining us today for our discussion. I've been talking to Blaine Neufeld. His book is titled Public Reason and Political Autonomy. It was just published by Routledge Press. You've been listening to New Books in Philosophy. Thanks, and bye for now.